Welcome to Good Dogs. I'm Tracy Hotchner, here with my co-host Carol Borden. She's a veteran trainer who founded and runs Guardian Angels Medical Service Dogs after 60 years as a dog trainer. The companion dogs that she raises prove every day what we believe. All dogs can be good dogs. We believe dog training starts with people training. We're here to help you understand and communicate better with your own dog and bring out the good in him or her. Carol, one of the things that is very important to your work, because you breed and raise every service dog, almost every service dog you place with somebody after years of training, the topic of genetics is something that most of us don't think about too much in terms of how it shapes who that dog will be. Can you talk about the Princeton University research results? And you have very deep knowledge about genetics. Just talk generally, if you would, about the genetics of dog breeding and then how you make decisions.
Sure, absolutely, Tracy. The research program that we did with Princeton University was a result of the dogs that do not pass service dog programs across the country nationally. About 60% of the dogs are not capable of doing this kind of work, either through genetics or training. And so what they were wanting to do was identify what are those, can we identify the genetic markers that make up the basic characteristics that a dog needs in order to become a service dog? And so they sampled 804 dogs across the country. We submitted 59 of those samples from our breeding program, because 80% of our program is made up of dogs that we breed ourselves, because we have a much higher success rate with them. But little did we know, once the study was completed, that both our breeding program and another leader dog program that did their own breeding, across the board, all of our dogs had every one of the characteristics that were needed to be a service dog. And that's amazing. It's a huge money saver for people who are spending months or years putting a dog through training that isn't going to make it. Now, I will quickly say that that is only 50% of the equation. The other 50% is environment, and environment's very important. But you start with a lot of basics. And this transfers over to pet dogs, too. It's not just for the working dog, although it's obviously more scientifically considered when you have working dogs, because there is so much money and training that goes into these dogs. But for pet owners that worry about why their dog is afraid of everything or why it does this or why it does that, if you dig really deeply and you look at the parents, if you even know the parents of those dogs, frequently you will see that there are certain traits that have been passed along.
This is riveting for those of us that are just lay dog owners, maybe even to people that have a guide dog for a guide dog because they're visually impaired or have a medical service dog. But we do not, until recently, there was no way to look at these genes. So when you talk about this study from Princeton University, it's almost like you can look back. Obviously, it's a look back machine, because you were doing everything or many things extremely well and right, and you had no way to look at the genes, but you were evaluating the mother and father dogs and looking at the outcomes of their litters to see which combinations of dogs produce the most successful service dogs. So now really this, I'm asking this while I'm saying it, does this not validate your own instinct, intuition, and careful observation?
You know, it did, Tracy, and we were so excited. But it also has to do with a lot of common sense. You know, obviously, I've worked with a lot of dogs for a very long time. And so to me, things that may seem obvious or natural may not be as natural to a pet owner.
Right.
And so what I was always looking for, what are the strengths and weaknesses of the dogs that I want to breed? Because you, of course, want to concentrate the strengths, but you want to make sure you complement any weaknesses.
Nice.
And oftentimes people aren't looking at the whole picture. They love their dog. Listen, there's two reasons pet owners breed their dogs. They either love their dogs and want to keep a puppy, or they're just wanting to make money. There is no other reason. And so even if you want to keep one of the puppies, you can't keep the whole litter. So you are still making money unless you're giving them away. And unfortunately, what happens is they are not looking at it from a scientific analytical perspective. They're looking at it from the other two equations that I mentioned. And as a result, they're not looking at what the strengths and weaknesses are of the dogs. And all too often, they are amplifying the weaknesses. And that continues to get passed on, whether that is mental or physical. It can be either right. or both.
So we'll talk about breeding. We'll do a separate show about breeding. I'm sure we both have a lot of knowledge and a lot of opinions about who is breeding dogs in the United States. How are people acquiring dogs? There's not that much backyard breeding going on as there was even when I first wrote the Dog Bible. People just kept their dogs intact very responsibly. And once in a while, somebody jumped the fence, quote unquote. And then there was a litter. And then the dog may or may not have then been spayed or neutered. A whole nother conversation, which I've been talking about a lot on Dog Talk, the delay of spay neuter. But more importantly, in this case, is these genetic markers that have such a profound influence on what the dog's behavior, attitude, reactions are. And I think why this is useful in understanding pet dogs, dogs that were not purpose-bred, dogs that people got maybe from a shelter, maybe they bought them mostly on the internet, which is unfortunately where most people are acquiring dogs. But when they get them from a shelter or a rescue or they rehome somebody else's dog, these dogs with either fear aggression or aggression, or mostly timidity, people always jump to, oh, he must have been terribly abused. We've got to make up for all that abuse. Talk a little bit about fearful dogs, timid dogs, because I did buy a puppy from what I thought was a really responsible breeder, interviewed the woman for 2 hours. Everything she told me sounded great. It was all a pack of lies. Wanda's wonderful, but Wanda's scared of all kinds of things, and it has nothing to do with me raising her, even her first, you know, right. 7 3/4 weeks. Talk about that, because so many people have dogs that are fearful. You know, somebody walks in with a hat or wearing or carrying a garden hose. Oh, it was probably beaten by the garden hose. No, it's the dog may not have been beaten by anybody. The garden hose is terrifying. Exactly. Can you talk about that? Because you must have bold dogs. You must have dogs with self-confidence and boldness, but thoughtfulness. So those are very subtle differences in a dog's outlook on life.
Well, and you're absolutely right. And this is something that people don't have a thorough understanding of. First of all, you do have the genetic predisposition. You know, does this dog have a solid nerve base? Does he have, right. is he born with a solid natural affinity for confidence? And many dogs are not. And so if they do not have a good nerve base, if they do not have the genetic markers to be friendly, then chances are they are going to be an insecure, more nervous type of dog. Now, one of the things that we do, and the reason I said it's 50% genetics and 50% environment, is we make sure from a very young age that our dogs are being exposed to all types of different stimuli. And you also have to know when it's too much. You have to be yes. able to read a dog's body language mm-hmm. and know mm-hmm. when enough is enough, remove that pressure. Otherwise, you're going to go off the wrong direction and it'll become a negative to the dog. So let's say like you were using the garden hose, for instance, to the dog, that looks like some big rolled up thing or some snake or something weird that's spitting water out and they totally don't get it. Perhaps they already have a weak nerve base. They tend to be nervous or timid. And so you push it into their face and go, here, look, it's really okay.
Right,
in a dog,
right.
In a confined space, well, you just put the dog over the edge and he's slipping out now because this thing is going to certainly eat him.
Right.
And he has no escape. So now we have traumatized him and left a scar in his brain. I have a very special technique that we use when we do realize a dog is hesitant or afraid of something. We immediately stop. We don't apply any more pressure. We never pull on the leash. We never force the dog to come over and see it. Because now if you do force the dog, you are further exacerbating
yes.
the situation
yes.
and leaving a scar on his brain. If you ignore it, and you just move on, you've left a question mark in his brain.
Nice.
But if you kneel down between the dog and the item, you touch the item, touch his nose, touch the item, touch his nose, let him sniff your hand, go back and forth rapidly. I can guarantee you within 30 seconds every time, our dogs will take a step forward, check it out, and go, oh, okay, it's nothing. And they're over it.
Interesting.
But people don't realize this, and so they don't follow that. Or most of the time, they don't even recognize what their dog's body language is telling them.
Yes.
And they miss the signals completely. So now they're reinforcing a problem, particularly if the dog already was not born with a strong foundation. This is very important. Both these 50% pieces are very important. Now, you can have a dog that does not have a strong nerve base, that does get nervous or frightened easily, but you can work at building its confidence too. You know, we have different games that we play and different things that we do with the dogs that are confidence builders. And that's always highly recommended for a dog that does not have a good nerve base. So there are ways to work with it. But the number one most important thing is educating the human. Right?
Right.
And that's what you and I do on this radio show. We have to constantly strive to share the things that we have learned over the years from the dogs, the things that dogs have taught us, and share that with the public. Because dogs are amazing creatures, amazing. They have so many gifts that people do not have. And if we can work together to have a more clear communication, it's just absolutely amazing what we can do for each other.
That's the truth. And one of the things that's unique about Guardian Angel Medical Service dogs is that you breed them carefully, thoughtfully, cautiously. And then you raise those puppies from birth, not to then be sent off to a whole lot of foster puppy raisers, but they stay with you. They stay with you from that moment from birth, where they're handled and touched from birth and exposed to all the stimuli that you have scientifically decided will make them a more happy, confident, comfortable individual. And then all of the steps that they go through in life are managed by people with an enormous amount of training and scientific knowledge. I guess one of the things that's worrisome and why there is the 60% washout rate that the people in the various guide dog and seeing eye dog organizations don't like to call it, that they call it career change. What they're saying is that the dog is a failure at being the thing that they had hoped that dog would be. But if you give that puppy at 8 weeks or two and a half months, whatever the age might be, tiny, to a nice family in New Jersey, picking a state, that's a household full of people. And there's no one person watching every interaction that puppy has. So if the puppy falls off the couch and, you know, yelps and hurts himself and nobody notices, or the cat scratches him, or something falls on him or near him that startles him, no one's there to monitor how is he reacting. So by the time he has to look at an escalator and the nice puppy raiser just pulls him towards the escalator, says, come on, come on, you can do it. This dog has been pushed over the edge so many times and no one even knew.
That's highly possible. And part of the reason that we raise our dogs in a very controlled environment, we break them down by life stages based on their age, how much we feel that they can handle from training, playing, confidence building, socialization, so on and so forth. So they are getting socialized during that first year, but we are not sending them with a foster. Once they are far enough along and we have personally exposed them to as many things as we possibly can, and we deem them to be pretty solid for their age and stage of training, now we let them go to a foster.
I see.
Very opposite of what most places
do.
They put them out there at 8 weeks, leave them out there for a year to 18 months before they bring them back in. We do just the opposite. And as a result, our program is probably easily 30% more successful than the national average.
And the reason that that matters is that the dogs who are stellar in these other organizations, this isn't a sales pitch, by the way, for Guardian Angel Medical Dogs to anyone listening. I mean, someone should be so lucky to get these dogs for free, which is how you get them for free because of the incredible backers of the organization, of the nonprofit. It's really to show the differences in these organizations that are working so hard with so much passion and devotion to create and turn out the most valuable and valued service animal possible. And we can learn from it with our own dogs, because absolutely, these dogs, someone's life depends on the diabetic alert dog, the seizure alert dog, the seeing eye dog, which isn't what you do, but for blind or visually impaired people, lives depend on it. But even with our own dogs, for us to have the best quality of life and for them to have it, even if we get them later in life, we need to understand that what made them up is what happened to them in those early days, weeks, and months. And it isn't something necessarily awful. It's just that they were not respected for who they were. And they were pushed into situations beyond their ability to cope emotionally. And you wind up with a dog who's very timid or it does fear aggression, you know, doesn't want other dogs near him, doesn't want people near him, has all kinds of objects or situations that freak them out. And you're misunderstanding it. So I think that what you've learned, Carol, should be something. And when we'll do a show about breeding and breeders, and there's fabulous breeders with the American Kennel Club, incredibly responsible, deeply devoted to what they're doing. But fortunately or unfortunately, very much of their breeding, it depends on how the dog looks physically, how they react and react emotionally is lower down on the on that scale. So just to wrap up, what are those things you do with a dog to help them have a stronger nerve base, to be more brave and more confident? Just give an example of one thing that you might do with a dog.
Well, of course, you know, the breeding, you know, is the first step.
Of course.
But then let's say we've done the breeding. Now we have the results of the breeding. We've got these puppies. Now we begin in phases, very slowly introducing them to new things. They are constantly being rewarded and played with. We make the work they're going to eventually do games in their early life. So it's fun.
Nice.
And they adapt to it very quickly. We kind of direct and mold their play habits and the behaviors very early on and introduce them to things very slowly and make it all fun. So that encourages their confidence.
And I guess as a dog trainer who worked with just regular people and regular dogs before you had this passionate devotion to molding and shaping dogs that were going to give people liberty and freedom and even their lives, I imagine that having that attitude when you're doing any dog training, it has to be fun. If you act like a severe, harsh teacher and get frustrated and get angry, you got to step away because the dog is not learning in that environment, only learning when it's positive and fun and reinforcing something good. And when something not great happens, would you say in a nutshell that ignoring it is in a nutshell, I understand there's lots of permutations of ignoring behavior you don't want, but is ignoring it better than a harsh correction?
Well, we don't believe in harsh corrections as a rule, either ignoring it or redirecting it. Redirecting
right, that's better.
Is really what we prefer to do.
So if the dog jumps up, let's say the dog jumps up, right? You've got a big, gorgeous German Shepherd and you raise them from birth and they get to be that puberty of 6 or 8 or 9 months and they're full of excitement and enthusiasm and they jump up for joy to see you or to see their person or their trainer. What do you do with that? Because it's a joyful moment. They're greeting you, but how do you redirect that?
Well, we very quickly give them what we call a human growl. We tell them, and we turn so that they kind of miss us in the process of jumping up on us, which means that their front legs are going to come right back down to the ground before they jump again. And we immediately, timing is everything here, we immediately reach down to their level and pet them and tell them, good job. You know, four on the floor is what we're looking for in that instance. And so if they get rewarded every time they have four on the floor, then they no longer feel the need to jump up because you're jumping up because your level of attention, your focal area is your face. They can read facial expressions and of course, your tone of voice comes from your face as well. So if you can immediately come down to their level and thank them, redirect them, you know, either by standing with all four, asking them to sit and then being petted or giving a treat, you are automatically creating a new habit for for them to keep four on the floor.
So just in wrapping up, that is the right way to do it. And for so many of us, we're rushing and we're not paying attention. And then some people will say, but wait, that means you just rewarded him for jumping up, because people don't understand. We will have another conversation about that, Carol. You're rewarding the very last thing they did, not the thing they did three or four things before that. So people mistake it. And they're like, well, I'm not going to reward him for jumping up. No, sweetie, the dog already put all four feet on the floor, which is the thing we want to make positive. So I just want to say again that I think that your own years of really paying attention, very smart observation, have proven that genetics have an enormous part in what makes a dog who they are. So there's only so much we can do to change it, but certainly we need to understand it and respect it and work with it, not against it. And with your dogs, that's exactly what you do. You work with each one as an individual, knowing that they're probably the best package of dog that you can possibly bring into this world, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. And then it's up to us where we take it from there.
That's right. Exactly. Thank you all for listening. We love having you here. We hope that these sometimes technical conversations or conversations about dogs who are doing such brave and incredible work, they do have something to do with you and your dogs too. Keep listening, and we'll talk to you soon. Hope all your dogs are good dogs.